The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a continuation of our discussion that we had yesterday with Professor Nafees Ahmed. He is in England. He is one of the most remarkable minds, I believe, that we have available today. We're going to be discussing issues today, including, in a realistic way, what can those of us who see the tsunami coming do to get out of harm's way and still maintain a higher concept in living? Joy, happiness, sharing, all the things that we really prize, what can we do? I'll talk to him about that. I'll also ask him about questions I have concerning the official 9/11 investigation and some scientific forensic facts that challenge it. He was a person who contributed information. Also, what is the real nature of terrorism? We've been led to believe that we need to spend almost $1 billion a year on the war on terror. I believe that we have been induced into a state of mass panic and are exploited because of it. I also believe that's why we're in the endless wars of Afghanistan and Iraq and other places. I'll ask him about that. Prior to him coming on, we'll be going to a small village in Germany and speaking with Dr. Michael Hudson on what's happening with the dollar. This audience knows that 7 months before a single thing went wrong in the stock market, we predicted on this show, I did, five bubbles. I said that we have a subprime bubble, it will burst. A commercial real estate bubble, it also will burst. A hedge fund bubble, an equity partnership bubble, and a credit card bubble. All of those are happening. Now the question is, what's going to be happening to the value of the dollar and currencies? We will put this into lay language so it will be interesting. It will not be as dry as toast. Everyone has a stake in the outcome. Also, women are dying from hormone therapy. You will hear the most important information on this to protect your life and why you should say no to these ridiculous campaigns, masterfully done, brilliantly executed, where even the football players are wearing pink shoes on the field, but not a single person's being saved because of it. People are being put in jeopardy because of this massive campaign. And also, have we really solved the mystery behind the shocking dye be-offs? If you read the New York Times, you would believe, yes, they gave us the answer. And I will say, no, they did not. The real answer I will share with you today on why all of our bee colonies is anywhere between 20% to 40% of all the bees in the United States are dying. And with that comes the dying off of germination. So we have a packed show. I won't be taking calls today because of the information. It's just going to be bumper to bumper. First up, you've heard me mention the healing power and the killing power, bad bacteria and viruses of silver, colloidal silver. Silver is one of the oldest used medicines in the world and one of the most effective. This is from the Daily Reporter. Scientists strike gold. Silver bullets could beat the common cold. I'll quote this. It says, a silver bullet against the common cold and other illnesses is being developed by scientists. Tests show that arming bacteria with minute studs of silver endows them with the ability to combat viruses. Norovirus, the winter vomiting bug, is unable to cause infections after coming into contact with the silver impregnated bacteria. Researchers believe the same technique could be used to ward off other viruses, including those which cause the flu and the common cold. Belgian professor discovers a way of studying harmless bacteria often found in probiotic yogurts, with nanoparticles of silver, each thinner than a human hair. Sprayed up the nose or rubbed onto the hands, the silver-studded bacteria stop any virus that crossed their path by infecting the cells. As viruses need to hijack a cell internal machinery to live and breed, barring them entry leads to their death. The common cold wreaks havoc among all groups, but the huge number of different viruses behind the symptoms means that a cure has so far eluded scientists. Now, that's mainstream science done at a major university. By the way, there are dozens of medicines and other products that have silver in it. Let's go very simple. A throat spray. Colloidal silver throat spray. I take one with me, a little tiny sprayer, everywhere I go. It has about 200 parts per million of colloidal silver, which it's been broken down to a very small particle size. I get on an airplane, I spray it in my mouth. Every hour I'm on the plane, I spray it again in my mouth. You can spray it in your nostrils, which is one of the passageways for bacteria and viruses to enter the body. Kills them. I want to clean my hands, I spray colloidal silver. Better than alcohol, better than hydrogen peroxide. If there's a utensil that I'm uncertain about, if it's really sterile, spray it. Someone has colds and flu, well, I do two things. I recommend wild oregano oil, 20 drops every hour for 10 hours, and try to hold it, even though it's a little burning, in the mouth under the tongue so you can get it into your lymphatic system, and then follow that by spraying colloidal silver. So 10 times a day you spray the colloidal silver and the wild oregano oil. There are some other things, but those two things really do 90% of the work. So isn't it interesting? What we've been using in the natural health field for decades, mainstream science has just discovered. A lot of people have trouble sleeping. You'll see the ads on television all the time. By the way, I forgot to mention, you can watch today's program. I'm broadcasting live from our studio in New York City. And I want to thank all the people listening over the Progressive Radio Network. We had 16% increase in our audience in the last month. That's an enormous jump up. So people are passing the word around. But you can watch by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryNall.com, and we're video streaming. In another, I would say, 2 months, we should have our state-of-the-art studio built here. It'll be both a television and radio studio. And it'll be as nice and as large as those that you see in, let's say, Fox or NBC. In any case, 10 things that can sabotage your sleep, from Las Cruces, Sun, New Mexico. Well, I've been telling you, first and foremost, don't eat anything within 3 hours going to bed. Why? Because it's still going to be in your stomach. And if you've eaten anything that is spicy, you can end up with heartburn and gastric reflux, and that will cause insomnia. Also, drinking fluids 2 to 3 hours before you go to bed to avoid having to use the restroom in the middle of the night instead of later at night, because just having your bladder full will cause you to get up. So try to not take your fluids within, I would say, 3 hours. The next thing beyond food is light. Any light at all, any light from a clock radio or a television or a night light, will stimulate the pineal gland not to secrete melatonin. The white light that we see from televisions, it's not very bright, even when the set is off, can stimulate the brain and signal to neurons that it's time to wake up. Also, a lot of people work in bed, especially younger people, and avoid doing any kind of work or eating in bed, so you'll associate it only with sleep, not stress. A lot of people use their bed as a place to deal with stress. Will create an environment in your bedroom that is conducive to sleep. Dark, quiet, warm or cool, and comfortable. I suggest dark shades or curtains or eye shades, earplugs, And also, if you need some background, use a white noise machine, like fans, that will give you a certain ambient sound. Or if you like total silence, then use earplugs. If you're unable to fall asleep after half an hour, instead of tossing and turning, get out of bed. Engage in some relaxing activity, and then get back into bed. But don't exercise. If you exercise, you're going to stimulate your blood, your sugar, up, and you're going to stay awake. Also, remember when you were little and had a bedtime ritual every night? Keep up that as an adult and establish a relaxing bedtime rhythm. And little things like take a nice relaxing shower. Read something that you find inspirational, not exciting. Remember, you don't want to overexcite yourself because then you're not going to be able to sleep. And caffeine, avoid all of the drinks, coffee and sodas that have caffeine, and even chocolate, within 4 hours going to bed. Avoid taking long naps in the daytime if you've missed sleep the previous night. Take a short nap, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And significantly altering your sleep schedule on days off or weekends, that'll affect it. A lot of people think, oh, it's the weekend, I'll just stay up late at night. You do that, then you're going to find it harder to get sleep. And also alcohol. Alcohol may relax you or make you feel drowsy, but it disrupts sleep during the night by preventing you from entering into the deeper rapid eye movements of sleep. So when you have alcohol, you're not going to get a deep night's sleep. So no alcohol. Those are the things that will help you. Also, you could take 2 milligrams, 3 milligrams of melatonin. For those of you looking to help your cholesterol levels, dark chocolate can reduce the cholesterol levels for people with diabetes. And that's an important finding from Hall York Medical School. They found that 45 grams of dark chocolate was very beneficial. Quote, "This study demonstrates that it can offer potential reduction in cardiovascular risk without detrimental risks on weight, insulin resistance, and glycemic control," unquote. That's Steve Atkin, professor of diabetics and endocrinology, who led the research team. And the reason is because of the polyphenols. The polyphenols are found in a variety of foods, mainly in fruits, and chocolate's very good in them. So if you want 1 ounce, maximum 2 ounces of chocolate, then that's less than a large banana, but you're going to get an awful lot of the polyphenols, and that will help you lower your cholesterol level. And that's all good. And that's mainstream science telling us that, so that was important. And finally, blueberries halt hardening of the arteries. This was a good study, and it was done at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Research Services Arkansas Children's Nutrition Center in Little Rock at the University of Arkansas Center for Medical Science. What they found, published in the Journal of Nutrition, was that blueberries can make an enormous difference in helping with the plaque in the arteries. And this is what they say, quote, "For the first time, scientists have direct evidence that a side effect, free natural substance exists that can help prevent those harmful atherosclerotic plaques from increasing in size and narrowing arteries." What is this powerful hardening in arteries, Fighter? Blueberries. So the more blueberries you get, in this case they gave a group of rodents the blueberry powder for 20 weeks, and they found that it was substantially beneficial on helping remove plaques. So, blueberries, one more thing it does, all good for you. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Happy day.
I'd like to welcome all of you, all of our WMYE audience members. Thank you for being there. I just saw the latest Arbitrons, and the audience is growing exponentially. We now have more people listening to this hour than the entire half day of the station combined. That's tremendous, because when we came on, we were 14th place. We're going to go to our guest in one, Dr. Michael Hudson, who's in Germany, and over in the United Kingdom, Professor Nafees Ahmed, in a moment. Just one quick program announcement. Tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday, from noon until 9 at night, 2 days, I'm going to be offering people in this audience who want to buy bulk 25-pound bags of grains and legumes, everything from brown rice, jasmine rice, pearl, barley, buckwheat, kamut, French couscous, millet, quinoa, red quinoa, over 30 different items in bulk at my wholesale price. This is a public service. I do it with beans and grains because, like myself, many people believe that it is always best to have a backup, so that if a crisis occurs, if needs occur, if unemployment exists, or even if everything in your life is perfect, what about the friends and family who could use some food? And so just this past year alone, I probably gave enough food to feed around, anywhere 2,000 or 3,000 people from my own private stocks. And yet I continue to replace those stocks because I'm one of those people who happen to believe that you don't wait to a hurricane to buy the generator. I have generators, and I have solar power, and I have a backup water system, and I have backup food for 3 years. Now, someone could say, isn't that a little being overly cautious? Compared to what? Compared to the person that didn't believe they would drop dead of a heart attack and lose the weight? The person never thought they'd get cancer and couldn't stop smoking? The person who didn't feel that the ocean would rise and wipe out their beach property, or a hurricane would wipe it out, or the woods would be so dry they'd burn down their house. Everywhere you look in our society, where do you see absolute total security? More often than not, it doesn't exist. It's an illusion. So I believe one of the things we all need, food. And food that does not go bad can stay for years in dry storage. So it's just for those who are ahead of the curve. And what you can do, you can go up at 89th and Broadway, Saturday and Sunday. And you'll be given a list, you make your selection, and you pay for it, and then they'll call you later in the week when it comes in, and you can take it with you and store it. And keep it for that rainy day. Keep it if you ever get unemployed, or share it with people who are friends and family in need, if that should happen. And do I believe the need's going to happen? Oh, you bet. Wait till you hear Michael Hudson and his views on this. So that's Saturday and Sunday, and my health food store number is 212-874-4000, 89th and Broadway. I'm going to be hiring a PR person for 2 weeks to help us with a major new promotion. I'm going to be hiring a vitamin person for my vitamin counter in the health food store, and I'll talk with people on Monday about that. And finally, before we go over to our guest, I didn't have a chance, except for the last 2 minutes of my program yesterday before we left our WMYE audience, to mention this special, so I'll mention it again. one of the things we need in order to slow down the aging process is adequate antioxidants. Antioxidants come in two forms, those found naturally in food and those in supplement form. I believe we should use both. But how to get it? The average person just doesn't. Eating an orange, eating an apple, taking a little vitamin C, that isn't going to do it. One of the reasons that I know about the aging process is because I've spent my entire adult life as a clinician, an activist, a scientist, a professor, a counselor, working with people on the diseases that emanate from the aging process, the premature aging process. Free radicals, that's the culprit. And the inflammatory agents, that's the culprit. But it works slowly. You don't just have a hamburger and drop dead. You don't drink one glass of alcohol and get cirrhosis of the liver. You don't smoke one pack of cigarettes and get lung cancer. It takes time for diseases to exist, and then you tip, and when you tip, that's when you say, oh my God, I've got something. No, you've been building up to that for years. So my idea is, let's get ahead of this. Let's each and every day do something that is going to trap an awful lot of free radicals, flood the body with antioxidants. So I created this product. This is my own invention. It has ORAC. ORAC is what you do to grab those free radicals, the ultimate antioxidants, the ultimate healers of that free radical process. It's all natural. It's raw. It's vegan. It's Circle K kosher. It has the superstar fruits, 22 fruits, and 15,000 ORAC. No other product I'm aware of on the market today comes even close to this. So this is the superstar. This is the gold standard for excellence in a natural product that tastes phenomenal. It's called Power Berry Blast. It's new and improved. Diabetics, you'll love it. You can use it. It only has 40 calories per serving. And it tastes great. But then I put on here the actual milligrams, and you're getting really high milligrams of acai berry. You're getting 1,500 cranberry, goji, red raspberry. Look at the science on red raspberry. You'll know why I included it. On strawberries, on blueberries. I have blueberries in here, almost 800 milligrams. That's more than they use that study. I just mentioned elderberries, noni berries. We're not talking about 5, 10, 15 milligrams. You can find some products. We're talking about 1,500, 1,500 milligrams of some of these black cherry juice and black raspberries. I had red raspberries, then black raspberries, then blueberry leaf extract and Camus and black currants and pineapple and guava and raspberry seeds and grape seeds and aronia, quercetin. It's all here. Delicious, nutritious, loaded with antioxidants from the superstars in the world of fruit. And nothing in here is duplicated in red stuff. So, it's a special and a big discount. I mean a big discount. So give a call now, and all the money goes to this radio station. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Or you can drop into our two vitamin closets on 92nd and 2nd tomorrow, or and today, or at 83rd and Broadway. But this will be shipped out tomorrow. All right, and you get a great special and a phenomenal product and brand new and new and improved. And we just got the shipment in yesterday morning, so you get it out. Back in a moment with our guest, and then we're going to rock from there. Please stay with us.
It only comes out when the moon is on the run, and all the
to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to be going overseas and speak with two gentlemen now who have a great deal to say that can help us guide our steps in the near future and better understand, in the midst of so much uncertainty and crisis, what can we do to make better choices as individuals and then seek out those who share a common idea of a sustainable, more holistic and spiritually based future. Also, let me mention that for our WMYE audience, my last mention before the weekend, that Monday evening at 8 p.m., we will be having the worldwide premiere of Autism Made in USA. This is a major film on what we believe that we have been able to definitely prove are the man-made reasons for autism, not some genetic disorder, but rather the cumulative environmental exposures and the vaccines, both in single vaccines with thimerosal and combinations. That will be followed by an hour discussion with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and Dr. Eisenstadt and other experts in the field, which you're welcome to join in, ask questions, and that starts at 8 o'clock. You can go to GaryNoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to sign up. It's only $4.95, and you can see the film from 8 o'clock tomorrow, Monday evening, until 24 hours, as many times as you want. And let people know about it. From what I understand, I was just told by our social media person that 2 million people on Facebook looked at the information on it. How many will actually come on and watch the film and share, I don't know yet. Let's now go to our guest, my guest from yesterday, Professor Naveez Ahmed, is in Sussex, England. As I mentioned yesterday, he is the executive director of the Progressive Institute for Policy Research and Development, a British independent organization for transdisciplinary security studies. And we're going to be analyzing a lot of issues as a follow-up to yesterday. He is also the author of A User's Guide of a crisis to the Crisis of Civilization. And I'm going to welcome him back now. Nice to have you back with us today, sir.
Thanks for having me on again, Gary.
I'm going to have Dr. Michael Hudson share some thoughts first with us, and so you can get a perspective on some of the ideas that Dr. Hudson has. Do you know Dr. Hudson?
I don't know him personally, but I'm very familiar with his work. Great fan.
Good. Well, let's go over now and say hello to Dr. Michael Hudson. He's one of our nation's important economists and Wall Street financial analyst. He is currently president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and was the chief economic policy advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich. And he has served as an advisor in the White House, State Department, Defense Departments at the Hudson Institute. And he is the author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of the American Empire, and The Global Fracture, the International Economic Order. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
Hi, thank you, Gary.
Michael is in a small village in Germany. Michael, I want to read what one of our listeners said. His name is John Best. When he found out you were going to be on the show today, he says, Does Hudson analyze what we have to do to take control of the Fed from the criminal bankers, or is he just another pseudo-expert who agrees to be bound by their dishonest practices? That said, let me read an article that ties into your article. I just read your article this morning, The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Bankers Fleeced America.
The other Michael Hudson. There are two Michael Hudsons, and he was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. It's a very good book. I like him. We're friendly. And we're about to publish an interview between the two Michael Hudsons, but that's Michael W. Hudson.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Who lives in Brooklyn. It's not me.
Because, you know, they don't have the W in the title here.
They should have put it in. I urged him to do it, and he said that apparently that his literary agent thought the book would sell better without the W.
Well, probably would. Anyhow, let me just go over this briefly and explain to our audience why this is important for everyone to understand. And to do that, I'm going to read a brief piece here that is germane to this. This says the following, and this is the Daily Caller. Tomorrow a bank, not your bank, but any bank, could evict you from your home, even if you didn't know the bank was foreclosing, even if your mortgage is paid off, even if you never had a mortgage to begin with, even if the bank doesn't hold a single piece of paper that you signed. And major banks not only know this fact, but have spent millions of dollars to defend it in court. Why? The answer starts with a Jacksonville homeowner named Patrick Jeffs. In 2007, Deutsche Bank sued Jeffs for his home, which is a necessary step in the process of foreclosing on a homeowner in the state of Florida. Curiously, despite the fact that he immediately hired a law firm to defend his property when he found out about the foreclosure, neither Jeffs nor his attorneys were at the trial. That's because it had already happened. Deutsche won it by default because Jeffs wasn't able to travel backwards in time to attend, even though the trial featured a signed affidavit indicating that he had been served his court summons. The only problem with the summons Jeffs supposedly received was it had been conjured out of thin air. In June of this year, a Florida court ruled that the document was fraudulent, as the person who was supposed to make sure Jeffs was served had mysteriously received a copy of the summons before the lawsuit had even been filed, and Jeffs never even saw a copy. The text of that ruling was posted on various financial news websites in September. The lawyers that Jeffs hired to defend his case say that fraud such as this is not uncommon. It is widespread and has cost countless people their homes. Quote, "This is what's important, Michael. I think it's safe to say that 95% of the foreclosed homes involve some form of fraud on the part of the bank," according to David Goldman of the Apple Law Firm. And, quote, "It's probably closer to 99%. The court system is helping get away with it. A 95% rate of fraud sounds preposterous, but the number was repeated by a paralegal familiar with the case, Liza Beasley, who, as well as Michael Redman, who was promoted to create a website called foreclosurefraud.org after enduring personal experience with the matter. There's a reason for them to say no. They take the report on a lot of foreclosure fraud cases, but there's also a reason that they devote so much of their time to their cases, just like there's a reason that multiple states are suing major banks for this type of fraud." Now, then there is the article I read this morning, and I'll just give you an overview of it. The article is about...
The book. He sent me the book.
Okay. The article is... this is for the rest of our audience. The article talks about a story. The story upon which most of this home foreclosure mess rests. And that was a Ameriquest mortgage. And an employee who went to work there and started seeing that how people were forging everyone's names to documents, getting them to sign documents they had never read, making him promises that were out-and-out lies, all so that the company could make anywhere from $3 to $6 billion a month. And then these mortgages were bundled off to Wall Street. Wall Street then promptly put them all together and then sold them off. And the whole basis of these mortgages were to get people to get mortgages they couldn't afford, lie to them and tell them it was a fixed mortgage when it wasn't, and people would suddenly get their payments and see that, gee whiz, their interest was 11% or 12%. And they didn't recognize what they had signed. And a lot of times they didn't even sign these things. The actual important documents were forgeries. And this was rampant. This was endemic across the whole system out there. So now, here's the question. I want you to discuss this with us. Is it probable that all of the fraud, we're talking about millions and millions of cases of fraud perpetrated against the American public by the mortgage brokers and banks, that it'll all go away because this president, this administration, the Democrats and Republicans together, and Wall Street behind them, could not bear the financial payback if they had to be held legally and financially responsible for what they've done to the American public? And what is the probability, just like Obama gave a clean bill of health to all the people lied about the war in Iraq, and all problems and all crisis and all
all of the violations, constitutional liberties, everything from torture and waterboarding, breaking treaties, every single major crime committed by anybody in this administration or the last administration or the administration before them is simply washed away. But if you, Michael Hudson, break any law, you will be held accountable. Are we at that level now where we simply have two Americas, one that can do whatever it wants because it has the power to do so, and the other that is held in accountable for any action that it makes? Your thoughts, please.
Well, Obama a few days ago and his policy advisors did say there is a double standard here. They said that the banks would go broke if the government enforced the law against the banks and made them obey the law. And because Obama's major campaign contributors are Wall Street, he has appointed Geithner as Treasury Secretary that does what the banks tell him to. His administration is the most pro-bank administration probably in recent history. So Obama says we need to sustain the fraud, because if we didn't, the banks would go under. And he believes that we need the banks to revive the economy. What the banks produce is debt. Let's get back to the fraud issue. You, as you've been reading the passages, there are many different kinds of fraud here. When you talk about 99% of the bank mortgages being in fraud, you're talking about some, a technical fraudulent lie. They had forged the signatures of notary publics, and the basic principle of property in this country for over 200 years has been that if there is a document, there has to be a notarization. A notary has to witness the signature so that the person actually knows what they're signing. These documents were not notarized because the banks say it would cost us probably $20 if $30 to pay a notary, and we can have a computer do this for a tenth of a cent. And Obama said, well, we want you to earn your way out of debt, and if this costs you money, then you won't be able to lend so much. So Obama gave them carte blanche to break the law. The Federal Reserve encouraged them to break the law. Technically, 99% of the mortgages could and should be annulled. They are fraudulent. But I think you've gone much too easy on the banks, Gary. You're only this 99% is only the bank fraud in the signatures of the notaries. The deeper fraud is why all of this came about. Ellen Brown wrote an article recently on Huffington Post showing that the reason these frauds take place is because the banks have cut up the mortgages and sold them to suckers, especially suckers in Germany, where I am now, but also suckers in England and other countries. And it is in the process of dividing them up, they turned all of these mortgages over to MERS, a mortgage collection company. They did this in order to avoid paying taxes. They did this illegally. It was illegal tax evasion, and they made about 80 or 90 billion dollars on this simple fraud there. So for tax fraud alone, these people should go to jail. But it's even worse than that. The FBI already 3 years ago did a study and found out that the banks use crooked mortgage companies, crooked appraisers, and crooked lawyers, so that all of the mortgage packages they saw, 90% of the mortgages written up by mortgage companies and lawyers were themselves fraudulent. So you have three different kinds of fraud going on, and the bank fraud is only a money-saving fraud to make it easier to take homes away from people that were illegal in the first place. Under American law, these debts should be wiped out, and in fact, under New York law, there's a law of fraudulent conveyance that says if a creditor makes a loan to a borrower that is not is beyond the ability to pay, the loan is called null and void. Now, this problem that you just discussed about people losing their homes came up even before the American Revolution in New York State. You would have British sharpies and lenders come over here. They'd make a loan to a farmer. And then they'd foreclose just before the crop came in. They'd ask for payment, which you're allowed to do at that time, and the farmer couldn't pay, and the creditor would take the land. And that's why New York State wrote the law of fraudulent conveyance, and that's still on the books because it was retained after independence. So we're talking about laws that go back older than the United States itself that are all being violated. From the original loan was violated. The turning was a fraud. The turning the loan over to a mortgage collection agency to get tax exemption on this and a tax benefit was a fraud. And then the forging of a notary public signature was also a fraud, quite apart from what's called sewer service, not really letting the homeowner know that they're being evicted. So there are at least four layers of fraud going on, and that's part of the system that was put in place by Larry Summers, who Obama appointed as chief economic advisor. The advisors Obama has appointed are the people who designed this fraud, who promoted the fraud, and who encouraged it for the banks and continue to encourage it. So Obama, quite honestly, 3 days ago said, shut up about fraud, shut up about mortgages. We need to foreclose in order to keep the banks quiet.
Okay.
I think the only thing that people can do at the coming election is to shame the Democrats and say, look, we're going to throw you out. And I think this is what the Tea Party people are saying. Despite the fact that they're backed by the most right-wing, wealthiest people, at least they say we're not going to give away to Wall Street. Well, of course, they are going to give away to Wall Street. But I think that the anger you see and the anti-Congress vote and the anti-Obama vote is just a reaction against the fact that Obama has given $13 trillion to the banks to make them whole, and Obama's basic principle is that Wall Street and the rich should not have to take 1 cent loss, and in order to make them whole, the rest of the economy has to suffer, has to have about 3 million families losing their homes to foreclosure this year, and wage rates in this country have to fall by about 30%. And that's Obama's program for the next 2 years of his administration. So people should expect that to happen.
Michael, are you in Germany on Sunday evening?
Yes.
I would like to call you. I have a Sunday evening, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time radio program. I never have a guest, but I want to have you on to talk about the Federal Reserve, to talk about the value of our currency and where it's going, and the dollar, and what you see the BRIC nations and other currencies doing. And would you make yourself available Sunday evening for that discussion?
Sure. At what time? New York time?
New York time, it's 8 p.m.
Here's the problem. When it's 8 p.m. there, it's 4 in the morning here.
Well, Michael, just get up early. All right. Look, if you can't do it Sunday evening, we'll do it Monday. But I want to get this on the air, all right?
You can get it. Yeah, Monday would really be a lot easier.
Okay.
Four in the morning. I don't have the phone in my room, so I'm not sure that I would even hear the phone.
All right. Then I will call you, and we'll have you on Monday to talk about the Federal Reserve, what we can do with it. I'd like to abolish it completely, but I'll get your insight since you're far more aware of what we can do. Michael Hudson from Germany, we'll talk to you on Monday. Thank you very much.
Now
let's,
okay, thank you, Bruce.
Let's go over to Professor Amid, who is standing by. Thank you again for being on today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to raise three issues. Please address them as you choose. I believe that we cannot really make a judgment about the nature of terrorism by looking at what is being said by the military-industrial complex leaders on television, by people such as George Bush, who says God is on his side and telling him to go to war. I believe that we must make a very careful and dispassionate look at what is the underlying cause of terrorism. Why would a person choose to inflict harm or pain upon another person? And if one member of a community decides to go that route, but other members do not, then are we not being insensitive and imprudent by condemning a whole group? I would never condemn Christians, because of those that participated in the crusade. I would never condemn Muslims by those who committed acts of aggression and atrocity. I would have to look carefully at the underlying nature. Is this something that everyone is susceptible to? And the answer is almost always no. Then who is susceptible? What are they doing? And something, my second part, how do you believe, if you do believe, I happen to believe, but that's my own belief, that there are individuals, major individuals in our society, who profit from war, profit from keeping people in a state of overreaction, and with that comes prejudice and the denial of what is sacred and the rights of another human being or group or religion to exist. And therefore they keep it going, using some act to justify everything that happens against that act. So could you explain your positions if you feel that the people who continue to get us into a permanent state of war, their agenda in that? And finally, I would like for you to give us your view on what you believe we were not told about the 9/11 Commission report. I'm referring to the discrepancies in that 9/11 Commission report, the evidence that I have seen where there had been out-and-out lies and misinformation or information excluded that would give us a different perception, mainly what organizations or individuals may have known about the attacks before it happened, yet chose not to do anything about it. If you have knowledge on that, fine. If you don't, okay. But I know you have a lot of insights on the nature of terrorist and terrorism. The form is yours.
Thanks, Gary. Well, I think I'll try and deal with your questions in the order you raised them. And I think I'll start with the issue that we're facing now in terms of the permanent state of war that we're in. And that doesn't seem to end, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. And we've had only confirmations from officials that this is a war that can't end because of the nature of the threat. And one of the things I did when I was there's a chapter in my new book called International Terrorism, which distills some of my earlier research on terrorism. What I did at this is try to look at what is the current state of defense planning on behalf of the U.S. government as well as the U.K. government in particular. I do look at Europe as well, but I'm pretty interested in this alliance between the U.S. and the U.K. What are they planning? What are they saying about terrorism? And what are they saying about the future of war, the threat from various Muslim populations and so on and so forth? And I was very, very disturbed because what was interesting about some of the documents I looked at were like kind of Department of Defense documents, U.S. Army documents. This is stuff in the public record. People can go and find this and check it out, verify it. But basically what they were saying, they were looking at some of these crises that we were discussing yesterday, things like energy depletion, imminent kind of peak oil. They were looking at stuff like that. They were looking at things like water scarcity, food production declines, economic crisis. They're looking at the whole spectrum of crises. But again, rather than looking at the transformative implications of these crises speak to an urgency and the necessity of a fundamental change in the way we organize our societies. Rather than looking at that, the response was very much that these threats, these challenges, undermine an optimal system, a system that can't be challenged, a system that we must assume is perfect, it's at the peak of human evolution. And therefore, we have to look at the threats and how we can control and contain the system. So what was interesting is that the analysis looked at different parts of the world and how these converging crises would impact. And invariably, they focused on Muslim-majority countries, mostly because of the fact that Muslim-majority countries in the Middle East, Central Asia, North Africa happen to be home to some of the most abundant kind of natural resources, certainly oil, gas, also minerals that we use to produce a lot of the things that we require in industrial societies, they were focusing very much in Muslim majority countries for these strategic interests. And they were saying, well, over the next couple of years, maybe 10, 20, 30 years, they were projecting ahead, they were saying, though, populations in these regions are likely to rise quite high. And they were saying, in the context of these large population growth and kind of resource scarcities, these countries, these regions are going to be susceptible to major crisis. There will be a youth bulge, lots and lots of young unemployed people who don't have any outlet, who will therefore be vulnerable to radicalization, they said, to Islamist radicalization, to political militancy. What was also interesting, it wasn't just the Muslims that these guys were looking at. They were also talking much more broadly about other political bogeymen. So they were talking about kind of civil liberties movements. They were talking about general kind of left-wing dissidents. They talked about Marxist movements. And interestingly, a British document, a Ministry of Defense study from 2007, said that there's going to be a danger that there will be middle classes, and let's remember that many of the middle classes actually across Western Europe and the US have faced the brunt of the financial crisis and will face the brunt of a lot of the crises that we're talking about now. So they said that the report projects that there will be a disparate middle class groups across the world will unite to form a transnational movement that will unite with these radical Islamist militants elsewhere and create this dangerous terrorist movement of kind of fueled by middle class resentment. Now this is, when you think about it, this is very Orwellian, very fantastical. I mean, and I'm kind of waiting actually for the middle classes to kind of wake up, really. I think you sure probably are as well, Gary, waiting for the middle classes, waiting for our general average people to wake up and say, hey, we need a change. So, but it's quite interesting that when you have a specific way of looking at the world, where you're not interested in change and you think that the current unequal structures which benefit a few, you think that these are the best thing that we have, then inevitably you end up otherizing and demonizing not just other religious people of other religious faiths, such as perhaps Muslims, which is conveniently fits the agenda in terms of our energy interests, but also even people at home, people elsewhere who may end up resenting, and justifiably resenting, the inequalities that they're facing today. So that kind of puts it in context in this kind of this broader issue of this permanent state of warfare. So I'm very concerned that the lack of right thinking is radicalizing our elites. They're looking for a way of projecting the problem onto others rather than dealing with their own culpability. And warfare, permanent warfare, seems to be the order of the day. In terms of the issue of where does terrorism come from, well, there's two ways of looking at it. One is the kind of, I think the obvious kind of analysis, which I think is correct, that clearly, our foreign policy does generate grievances, and we need to be aware of that. And unless we change that policy, unless we change that interventionism, and then change that self-interest, then we're not going to see a major change in terms of the kind of hatred that a minority of people in the world hold for what we've done. It's not about hating our freedom or hating our way of life. It's about hating what our governments have done over the last 50 odd years or more in certain parts of the world, such as the Middle East. And I think this is very well known. I don't want to go into it in too much detail here. The third thing I think is issue with the issue of the third and the issue you asked about 9/11 dovetails with what I think is the second critical way of looking at terrorism, which is to look really at the origins of terrorism, not just in terms of, it's a reaction to some of the things that our governments have done, but also looking more critically at, actually, as you said, who are these groups? Where do they come from? Who is funding them? What gives them that ability to mobilize? And why is it that our intelligence agencies seem so hopelessly inept sometimes at dealing with these groups. Now, one of the interesting correlations I found in researching this over the last decade or so is that actually the narrative that we disconnected from Osama bin Laden, it's very well known that we financed bin Laden during the Cold War in order to kind of to counter the Soviet Union, counter international communism, and so on and so forth. That's very well known. What's not so well known is actually we never disconnected from Osama bin Laden after the Cold War. There is a whole host of very interesting, very reliable intelligence information which confirmed that we actually not only continued to maintain ties with bin Laden during the post-Cold War era until today, but that actually our connections with Osama bin Laden and his networks proliferated beyond Afghanistan in diverse regions such as the Balkans, Central Asia, the Asia-Pacific, the Middle East, and it's going on today. And there's many examples, and I don't want to go through too many in detail, but I mean, I'll give you a really simple example of something that was happening during the Bush administration very recently, and which is continuing today under Obama, which is the anti-Iranian kind of policy that has been going on, the anti-Shia policy. And under this policy, there was a presidential finding signed by Bush in 2008. And basically, a presidential finding is a disclosure to Congress of the deeds of a covert operation. And what he basically revealed was that the CIA was financing to the tune of about, say, $300 million or something like that, various anti-Shia groups across the Middle East and Central Asia. And in that process, most of these anti-Shia groups just happened to be al-Qaeda-affiliated Sunni militant groups. The same groups that, according to people like Seymour Hersh, for example, who has also looked into this, same groups that were actually involved in 9/11. So in order to counter Iranian influence, we were financing these guys. We know for a fact that this has had a detrimental impact on national security. The funding was apparently going through Saudi Arabia, which has traditionally been involved in this. It was also going through Pakistan. It was going into Iraq. It was going into Lebanon. It was going into Balochistan. It was going into Pakistan. All the key regions where we want to kind of get rid of Shiite influence. Now, the problem is that there's no indication that this policy has actually been officially rolled up. There's been no executive orders to repeal it. Obama has actually, obviously, as we know, he appointed Robert Gates as his defense secretary. Robert Gates was also Bush's defense secretary. So there's a continuity of policy here. We also had statements from the chief of what was formerly known as Blackwater, actually confirming that the anti-Shiite directive was still ongoing. So there are a lot of circumstantial indications to suggest that this policy continues. And that's just one example to illustrate that we are quite happy, our governments are quite happy to interface with terrorist networks when it suits them, and often for quite short-sighted geopolitical interests. But there is a more disturbing component to this, because as I've argued, this policy has gone on actually for more than a decade. There has been financing of militant groups such as this in the Balkans, for example, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, where we hooked up with groups financed by Osama bin Laden. This is very well known. It's confirmed by U.S. and British intelligence sources, by mainstream reports in newspapers such as the Sunday Times, New York Times, Washington Post. It's very well documented. Now, when you look at that whole history, you have to ask yourself, you know, there comes a point when you know you can't continue to kind of ignore the fact that this has gone on so systematically. But clearly, policymakers have to be at some level. I'm not saying that every government official is aware, or that everybody knows. But certainly, someone in the military establishment has to be aware that if you're going to continue on this policy, there is going to be a detrimental effect on national security, because these are the groups that basically are targeting American interests, targeting British interests, Western interests around the world, targeting innocent people. Now, if you're going to finance them, there's going to be a form of blowback. Now, how can you, so this really underscores the moral question, that if our leaders are able to finance these groups, at some level they're able to say, you know what, the real national security of our citizens is less important than the security of these particular interests. The security, for example, of the Trans-Afghan pipeline route that we wanted to go through when we were financing the Taliban in the 1990s, which was confirmed, by the way, by Donna Rofferbaker, ranking Republican. So, you know, there's a lot of things which, you know, I think which we need to look at. But then that kind of brings me on to the issue of the 9/11 report, the 9/11 Commission report, which, you know, I studied extensively for my one of my books, The War on Truth. I have to say, I'm very cautious about theorizing about what happened on 9/11. I don't want to offend anybody. I certainly don't want to offend the 9/11 families, who I have the greatest respect and sympathy for. And I do not want to offend the American people or the British people, some of whom also died on 9/11. So that's why I stay away from speculation and stay away from theories. But one thing is absolutely clear to me, is that from every element, when you look at the 9/11 Commission report, every element of that report is flawed. It's completely inconsistent on issues such as the intelligence failure, issues such as our interfacing with terrorist networks, issues such as the U.S. air defense failure, and of course the Commission report just doesn't look at some of the issues such as the WTC collapses. Which, I draw no firm conclusions, but the official theory of the WTC collapse is hopelessly flawed, and there were standard procedures which weren't followed on the day. So there are many, many things such as this which I think need to still stand completely open, and we need a new, proper, independent, official investigation of what happened in 9/11, and without that, you know, our national security, the national security of the U.S. and of all the Western countries, really remains completely open. You know, it's very, very it's full of holes, and those holes will not be tied up without a real investigation.
We agree with that. I didn't want to put you into a corner, but I'm glad at least you came out as saying, as many of us believe, and Danny Schechter's in studio right now. Danny's program follows the News Dissector show, and Danny is a Emmy Award-winning journalist, and he has made multiple documentaries.
I believe I've met your guest at in Congress when there was a day of testimony organized by Congresswoman McKinney some years ago on 9/11, an attempt to have a counter-investigation, which didn't get much press coverage, but I believe he was there. Is that right?
That's right, Danny, yeah.
So we did meet, and I have a lot of respect for your work because it's very factually based. It's not engaged in wild speculative theorizing, but you know what we do know and some of the implications of what we do know, which of course is, you know, not only true of 9/11, but the issues that you raise about various manipulations of facts, you know, can be seen in many contexts, including, as Michael Hudson was pointing out earlier, in the context of the financial crisis and the foreclosures that are ongoing in the United States now, where documents were forged, fraud is pervasive, and the like. And Michael, by the way, Gary, Michael Hudson, is in my film Plunder,
yeah,
The Crime of Our Time,
and
it's going to have a premiere in Harlem at the Maisels Theater on Tuesday, the 26th of October, and it's being hosted by Nelly, who's a host here on Progressive Radio Network. So that's 7 p.m. October 26th, the Maisels Theater. It's between 127th and 128th Street on Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem. So getting this out is important.
Next week, please come on and let's play maybe little two-minute segments of the show.
Love to.
And I'll be happy to come up there to the premiere, and we'll get people from the audience up there. We need to support it. We're out of time. Let us do this. I did not have a chance to ask you at all today. We didn't get to it. But will you make yourself, please, available one more time to come back so we can talk about the debt in our society and functioning as debt and making debt an asset that we've made and the mistakes of that?
Yeah, I can do that, Gary.
Great. Then we'll look forward to seeing you next week. My guest, Professor Naviz Ahmed. Again, he is, as Danny just mentioned, he is a scholar. He is a professor at the School of Global Studies, University of Sussex. He is an author of many important papers. We look forward to our discussion with him next week. Now, everyone, stay tuned for one of the more enlightened progressive minds in the media today, Danny Schechter.